Medical Frontiers is an informational program sponsored by the Allegheny Health Network. The information featured on Medical Frontiers is intended solely to further the public's general knowledge of current developments in the field of medicine and should not be relied upon as offering advice, diagnosis, or opinions as to any individual treatment or problem. Nothing should replace the relationship that you maintain with your personal physician.
Well, good evening. Dr. Gerald Pfeiffer here on Medical Frontiers. It's nice that there's a little more sunshine later in the day.
I'm loving it.
But missed that extra hour of sleep, right?
Yeah, I haven't been to bed yet, so I'm going to do that when I get done here. It's been a long weekend.
Okay, Medical Frontiers tonight, we're going to be talking about high-risk pregnancies and postnatal care, a very, very important subject, especially if you're contemplating pregnancy or if you are pregnant. And we're very fortunate to have two experts with us this evening on Medical Frontiers. They are both connected with Allegheny Health Network, both at the West Penn Hospital, a wonderful physical facility for pregnancy and high-risk pregnancy and perinatal care and also taking care of babies that are born prematurely or with other problems. It's a wonderful, wonderful unit. And I believe there's, 60 beds there now in the NICU? Is that right?
The new facility, I believe so.
It's quite a few. It's a big unit. And we're very, very fortunate to have two perinatologists with us. First, I would like to introduce Dr. Marta Koltoff. And Dr. Koltoff we'll ask her. She's originally from upstate New York, but she finally landed in Pittsburgh. She said the weather here is a little better than it is in upstate New York. But tell us a little bit about your background, and welcome to Medical Frontiers.
Oh, well, thank you for having me.
You bet.
So just like you said, I'm from upstate New York originally, but I've lived here in Pittsburgh longer than anywhere else, so I consider myself a burger at this point. So
that's great. And tell us a little bit about the training of a perinatologist. And what does that term mean, perinatologist? Peri sort of means around,
around the care of pregnant women and their babies. During pregnancy, during the time of delivery, and even postpartum.
So. Okay. And so you trained as an OB-GYN person originally, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then you needed to have some extra training.
That's right.
How long did you went to medical school for 4 years,
That's
right?
Correct.
After
mm-hmm.
4 years of college.
Mm-hmm.
So then how long in OB-GYN?
So 4 years of OB-GYN residency.
Okay.
And then 2 additional years of fellowship.
So 6 years after medical school.
Yes.
And then you have a special interest in maternal genetics, right?
That's correct.
Tell us a little bit about that.
So my interest is in reproductive genetics, and so helping families who have a known genetic disorder in the family, perhaps had a prior child diagnosed with a genetic disorder, or are pregnant and just want a general screening for genetic disease, or taking care of those women whose pregnancies are complicated by fetal genetic issues.
Okay, how mm-hmm. about autism? Does autism have a genetic component?
Well, autism is a diagnosis that encompasses a lot of different things. So it's a very, very broad term. There are some genetic conditions that are associated with autism, and some of those genetic disorders we can detect prenatally.
I just read not too long ago where there was a family that had 5 children. They were all autistic.
Mm-hmm.
That probably has something to do with their genetics.
Yes, yes.
To have that much, that mm-hmm. much penetrance, right?
That's true.
Okay. Yeah. Well, it's great having you here.
Thank you.
Meeting you and your partner here, Dr. Gordon Knight. He has been in practice at West Penn for about a year now. But tell us a little bit about your background, Dr. Knight. Welcome to Medical Frontier.
Thank you for having me as well. I just moved here, as you mentioned before. Just as Marta did, I did my OBGYN residency in 4 years. I did that in Columbus, Ohio, and did my fellowship in Indianapolis, Indiana. So I'm a Hoosier at heart in that sense. And moved to Pittsburgh for family reasons, and I really enjoyed the practice, the diversity of our group. We're a large group, but we each have our own interests and if we function well together. So.
And you're basically a Pennsylvania guy. You grew up in Erie, right?
Absolutely, yeah. I grew up in Northwest Pennsylvania, part of the snow belt. So it's nice to be back.
And Erie is a wonderful city beside the lake. It's not like Cleveland, which is a mistake by the lake, you know, so.
That's true. I thought you weren't on call anymore, Dr. Piper. I thought you retired, sir. That phone never stops ringing. That's because you're an important person.
Okay. So what about, say a woman is hypertensive and she's a type 2 diabetic, pregnant with her first child at the age of 35. High risk?
Absolutely high risk. And it's really important to have those things under control coming into pregnancy. So ideally, we like to capture these patients preconception if possible.
Yeah.
Regardless, it's our duty to, when they do become pregnant, to discuss risks both to mom and baby. The specific ones that you mentioned, high blood pressure and diabetes, both put moms at risk for pregnancy-specific complications such as preeclampsia and other pregnancy-specific complications such as growth restriction.
How about a 35-year-old woman with diabetes and hypertension? Are they at risk for even getting pregnant? Is it more difficult for that woman to get pregnant with those comorbidities?
There's, dependent on the degree of their diabetic care, yes. Age obviously also is a risk for patients to have more of an infertility background, as is the metabolic syndrome. So those are things that, from a counseling perspective, are important to have under optimal control before you
enter pregnancy. Okay. And Dr. Koltoff, being a maternal geneticist, I imagine that you sometimes come up with some problems that could be categorized as medical, legal problem or ethic problems. You know, say you find genetically there is some defect that has a high chance of being passed on to the next generation, their child. How do you handle that? Do you work with medical ethicists and so on, or how do you handle that?
So if we have a complex ethical issue, we can bring in the ethicists at the hospital. When we are faced with medical ethics issues, especially when it comes to prenatal genetic disease or preconception genetic disease, the first and foremost is to be upfront with the family and let them know that this is what the genetic testing may show, and make sure that there's informed consent regarding those issues and if they even want to go down that pathway. So that's the first and foremost.
Okay, well, we need to take a break. This is Medical Frontiers. We're talking about high-risk pregnancies and postnatal care. So give us a call at 866-391-1020. You can also email us on the Dollar Bank Instant Access at KDKRadio.com is the way you can email us. And you can also text us at the Wright Automotive line, which is 866-391-1020. Tonight, high-risk pregnancies and postnatal care. We'll be back. Okay, we are back on Medical Frontiers, and we're talking about high-risk pregnancy today and perinatal care. So give us a call at 866-391-1020. Okay, we don't have any calls in yet, and all our lines are available, so you can get in touch with us very, very easily at 866-391-1020. Dr. Koltoff, what is the incidence of high-risk pregnancy? Let's take all pregnancies. What would be the incidence of what you would consider a high-risk pregnancy?
That's a good question. I don't know if I have a precise answer to that. I do think, though, that given some of the common medical problems like diabetes and high blood pressure and moms having pregnancies later in life, more and more pregnancies are considered high risk.
So, okay, but, Dr. Knight, could you put a number on it?
Yeah, I think that number is escalating, but it's still not as common as I think you would assume. I'd say still in the low single digits, possibly 10%.
It's not as high as 10%.
I'd say 10 to 15%.
10 to 15%.
Yeah, on a rough.
Which is pretty low.
Yeah.
But when you figure there are millions of pregnancies in this country every year, we're talking about the number as being pretty high. Okay. And how about, Dr. Kolthoff, depending on where you live, this tri-state area, where at one time anyway, a lot of industrial, you know, steel mills, coal mines, et cetera, et cetera. And does the environment have something to do with high-risk pregnancies, the incidence of high-risk pregnancies? Maybe Dr. Knight?
Yeah, I think one of the major ones that kind of goes hand in hand with all of those is obesity. So as far as the moms that are becoming pregnant with higher body mass indexes is a huge component. That can be partially environmental. To answer your question as far as from a coal mine standpoint and some of the respiratory things that might be, I'm not 100% sure about that.
Let's take the 35-year-old woman now. No diabetes, no hypertension, but has a body mass index which is, you know, very, very high.
Sure.
How about that, Dr. Knight? Is that a high risk?
Absolutely, yeah. And that coincides with the degree of elevation. So they've classed obesity just in general medicine, so 1, 2, and 3. And as you kind of get into that 2 and 3 range, there are risks of things like stillbirth and small babies and the risk of preeclampsia and other adverse pregnancy outcomes.
A woman who is overweight, is it necessarily, would she necessarily have a larger baby?
No, and that's part of that would depend on what they were coming into the pregnancy. Like, as you mentioned before, the pre-existing conditions. If they don't have hypertension or
diabetes.
Obesity is actually one of the risk factors for macrosomic babies, of course, but they, ironically, they still can be at risk for growth restriction due to placental perfusion issues.
Okay. All right. How about a woman, Dr. Kolthoff, who is bleeding during her pregnancy, having some vaginal bleeding? Is that an indication that that could be a risky pregnancy?
Oh, most certainly. Depending on the trimester the bleeding presents, where the bleeding is coming from, it certainly could pose a high-risk situation for a patient.
Okay. How about if the amniotic sac breaks early?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, not, you know, as a woman has, you know, approached the 40-week, full-term mark the water breaks, say, at 36 weeks. How about that? Is that also a high risk?
It is a high risk situation, and the risk escalates the earlier that the premature rupture of membranes occurs, also known as PPROM.
Okay, Dr. Knight, what are some of the complications that can occur with early rupture of the membranes?
Absolutely. One of the most important, Dr. Kolthoff is referring to, is fetal lung maturity. Babies and fetuses are dependent on that amniotic fluid for maturation of their lungs. And the earlier that happens, the more consequential that can be post-delivery. Other risks that also play a part in this can be maternal infection and going into labor on their own, or something called abruption, which is where the placenta can separate early.
Okay, so could that be something that would push more toward a cesarean section or inducement of labor to have rupture of the membranes early on?
They're certainly at risk for that, but it's not a clear indication for that. If the fetus wasn't tolerating the situation, certainly those patients could be at risk for C-section. Our job, both of us, is to do what's safest for mom and baby. And if that is a safe delivery requiring C-section, of course, that is something that we would consider. However, though, most patients that do have premature rupture of membranes that otherwise have other indications to have a vaginal delivery can. And it would be those maternal risks I mentioned, infection or bleeding, that might lead us to augment sooner.
Okay, 866-391-1020 is how you can talk to our experts tonight on high-risk pregnancies and perinatal care. Dr. Koldhoff, how about multiple pregnancies, multiple fetuses in that uterus, twins, triplets, quadruplets, quintuplets, sextuplets? That automatically is high risk, right?
Oh, definitely. Definitely.
Tell us about that. Why?
Well, for a number of reasons. Probably the one that most people are familiar with is going into preterm labor. That certainly is associated with multiple gestations. Also, other medical issues tend to be more common with more babies. Gestational diabetes, hypertensive diseases, including preeclampsia. So,
and very often when there's multiple fetuses, they may have lower birth weights, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so that makes it risky for the fetus.
That's right. Correct.
Okay.
That's correct.
All right. And how about when somebody, say, is pregnant with twins, I mean, are they automatically sent to folks like you? Dr. Knight, is that one of the big reasons that you see a pregnant woman because they have twins or triplets?
It's certainly one of the more common ones, and a lot of the important pieces of that is the type of twins that they have, and that's dependent on the number of placentas that they have as pregnancies of twin pregnancies that are complicated by having one placenta or have other unique complications that should see one of us, specifically for ultrasound.
Okay, well, why don't we go to our phone lines? We have Rebecca in Verona. Good evening, Rebecca. How are you?
Fine. How are you?
Great. Do you have a question?
Yes, I do. My daughter is in her late 30s, and this is her first pregnancy. She's been following all along at McGee, you know, and getting ultrasounds and whatnot. And so far, everything, you know, has been very good. The babies, you know, the measurements and things are good. But she found out that, if I'm explaining this right, I might be wrong, that there are three valves in the umbilical cord, and she only has two. And the doctors don't seem to be too concerned about that. They just said that they have to watch, you know, just keep a close watch on her. Am I understanding this correctly, or am I not saying that right?
Okay, Dr. Koldhoff, first of all, let's talk about the importance of the umbilical cord and what sometimes can happen with that cord to cause risk of pregnancy.
Sure. Well, the umbilical cord is going to be that direct conduit of blood, oxygen, and nutrients for mom to baby. So, and typically the umbilical cord has three vessels, two arteries and
vessels,
one vein.
I'm sorry, I said valves.
That's
sorry.
Okay. I knew exactly what you were talking about.
Okay.
And if they find that there are two vessels rather than the typical three, an extended fetal anatomy ultrasound's performed to make sure there aren't any other issues going on with the baby. And if that's the only finding, then typically we follow those pregnancies just to make sure the growth is okay, but otherwise we're pretty reassuring.
Okay. Would there be like any... you know, like vitamins or like, you know, supplements to make sure that the baby's getting the correct nutrition? Or, and I know that she's starting to eat very healthy. She's not eating any processed, you know, she's really following a pretty healthy diet to do everything that she can, you know, to have a healthy baby. And this was just a little bit of a concern in the back of my mind. I mean, she said that they've had the baby, she's been tested, I think, for Down syndrome, and so far everything is, you know, negative for that, if I'm saying that correctly.
Okay, we're coming up a real tight break here. Anything that she can do to change things as far as
diet? It sounds
like
she's doing everything she needs to do.
Absolutely.
Okay. Very good. Thank you very much for the call, and we wish the best with your daughter and her baby. This is Medical Frontiers, and we're talking about high-risk pregnancies and postnatal care. Give us a call at 866-391-1020. We'll be back after the break.
The following program is paid for by the Allegheny Health Network.
Okay, we're back on Medical Frontiers, and we're talking about a very, very interesting subject this evening, and that is high-risk pregnancy and perinatal care. So give us a call, at 866-391-1020. All our lines are available, and you can also get in touch with us. If you don't want to call, you can send an email on the Dollar Bank Instant Access at kdkradio.com. And also on the text automotive line, you can text us. Text us on that line, 866-391-1020. Dr. Knight, how about technology? You know, most of the subjects that we have here on Medical Frontiers are talking about minimally invasive procedures, better testing, and so on. As far as your field of high-risk pregnancy and so on, how has technology improved the way you practice?
That's a great question. One of the major things we do day-to-day is our ultrasound for screening and detection of fetal anomalies and other twins, all those other things we mentioned, placental issues. And the earlier we can detect those, oftentimes we can offer more to patients as far as what they can plan for in their with the future of their pregnancy. For example, doing an earlier, what we call an anatomy survey, at 15, 16 weeks can make a huge difference as far as planning and testing as it would if we years pass where we wouldn't able the resolution of that ultrasound and what we have to identify some of those things are found earlier and more often.
Okay, so the earliest ultrasound, a woman thinks she's pregnant, missed a couple periods. What is your recommendation as to the first ultrasound?
For a lot of these high-risk conditions, it's really important to have good dating, which oftentimes is early, though that as that 5 to 6, 7 week range, because that dating helps us counsel patients as far as delivery timing and frequency of surveillance. And just as it is, earlier ultrasound is more reliable than a later ultrasound. I think that's a misconception to a lot of people.
Okay. Let's say a woman, she feels like she's pregnant and she's had to get a pregnancy test and she indeed is pregnant. And she has seen her obstetrician who has taken care of, say, two other previous pregnancies and so on. And now there is some problem, okay, that her routine general obstetrician thinks that she's high risk. When now does he or she make a referral to you early on if that is a high risk pregnancy? How does that work logistically?
Absolutely. If it's something that they identified at that new OB visit, which typically oftentimes will happen, like as you mentioned, right when they find out that they're pregnant and they're within the first few weeks of their pregnancy. How it functions at Allegheny is the provider will send a referral for either an early ultrasound and or a consult, and we try to get them in as soon as possible. The ideal situation, like I mentioned, is if preconceptually we can see some of these patients with the comorbidities to talk about the best time to get pregnant and for best outcomes.
Now, does that individual continue to follow with her regular OB and also follow with you?
Absolutely. It's really important to us to have the continuity with their private doctor. There's a trusting bond that they have, and we want that to continue for sure.
Okay. And also, with you, Marta, who makes the recommendation as far as genetic testing is concerned? Is it your feeling that most women should have some genetic counseling, or when does that subject come up in your practice?
Well, as a geneticist, I think most patients would benefit from genetic counseling, but that just isn't feasible, you know, from a resources standpoint. Typically, what happens is the primary obstetrician will do, he'll have a discussion with the patient, see where their thoughts are in terms of genetic testing, what they'd like to pursue, and also what their family and personal history involves, and see if they can do a little bit of risk stratification and then refer to us based on that.
Okay. So it's, and like I say, it just doesn't make sense from an economic standpoint to genetically test everybody. But genetic counseling mm-hmm. is not necessarily followed by genetic testing unless there's an indication for it, right?
That's correct. Although there are recommendations, one by the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology, that all pregnant women should be offered genetic screening for what we call aneuploidy, chromosomal problems that can occur during pregnancy.
And I think, we talking about screening for everybody, one of the things that is very impressive to me with the West Penn effort over there is screening for depression, even in the pregnancy stage, not the postpartum depression that we see afterwards, but screening for it early on so that you see if this woman is perhaps a candidate for being depressed postpartum. And do you agree with that, that that's a great screening tool?
Oh, certainly. Screening for perinatal mental health issues is really, I think, very important and so timely, too.
Okay. Yeah. Dr. Knight, in a high-risk pregnancy situation, how important is it to involve the partner of the pregnant woman and also from a mental status, how important is that as far as seeing a psychologist or a psychiatrist and so on in a high-risk pregnancy? And how do you handle that as far as the whole family is concerned?
I think it's a very important part. There's different aspects of that, including the patient's experience of the pregnancy itself. In terms of the component of mental health, to tag along with what Dr. Koltoff had just mentioned, it's really important to have a support system that's not just the patient and her. It's not just her pregnancy; it's the family's pregnancy, and I think that movement's been addressed a lot better, specifically in society, even with early pregnancy and early pregnancy loss. I think those are things that to have the support of a partner are absolutely paramount.
Okay. One of the things I just thought of in talking to you, we talked a bit about IVF possibly being a category of high-risk pregnancy and so on. Are there times, let's say a woman has a good genetic history, but perhaps her husband does not. Maybe her husband is the carrier of any number of things that could be passed on to the next generation. Is that an indication where using somebody else's sperm to have an IVF procedure is sometimes recommended?
It's certainly offered as an option. So we do see couples where one partner or the other may be a carrier for a certain genetic disease and have concerns about the possibility of passing that on to any of their children. And so one option very well may be either sperm or egg donation and then in the setting of in vitro fertilization.
Okay, what would you say are some of the most common things? I mean, I look at things like sickle cell anemia. Mm-hmm. I look at muscular dystrophy, those types of things. What are the most common that you can think of that you see in as far as genetics are concerned?
So we have a number of patients referred who are carriers for cystic fibrosis, okay. Spinal muscular atrophy, also Fragile X syndrome. We also have patients who may be balanced translocation carriers and may be at risk for having pregnancies complicated by chromosomal problems
okay.
as a result of that.
Very good. Okay. This is Medical Frontiers. We're talking tonight about high-risk pregnancies and also postnatal care. So give us a call at 866-391-1020. We need to take a break. Next week, we're going to be talking about child and adolescent mental health. So another sort of a beginning of life type of subject, but very, very important. We know that we all go through some changes, of course, with adolescence and so on. Sometimes people handle that pretty well, and sometimes they don't, including parents of those children. So that's what we're going to be talking about next week. But this week, it is high-risk pregnancy and perinatal care. We'll be back. Okay, we're back on Medical Frontiers and talking with our two guest physicians this evening about high-risk pregnancy and perinatal care. with Dr. Kolthoff and also Dr. Knight. A couple lines available. You can call in at 866-391-1020 and talk to our experts. Let's go right to the phone lines, and let's go to Rick in the Hill District. Good evening, Rick. How are you?
Okay. What's the percentage of a woman having miscarriage and live birth?
The percentage of miscarriages? Okay, I heard one time that 25% of women will miscarry even if they don't know that they did. Is that a good number, Dr. Knight?
I think that's a rough estimate just in general to counsel people. Maybe a little high, but the 20% range, I think,
okay,
for anybody that just any pregnancy can end in that outcome, yes.
So, and so that's pretty high. If you say a 20%, that's one in five women in their reproductive lifetime could have a miscarriage, which is a spontaneous abortion. For some reason, that pregnancy is not a good pregnancy, right, Dr. Knight?
Absolutely.
And they have a miscarriage.
Absolutely. And a lot of times to tie into my partner, a lot of times we think it is a genetic or chromosomal problem that is the trigger for that early loss.
And sometimes I think that's just nature's way. If that implantation is not a good implantation, if it's not a good viable fetus, Dr. Kolthoff, that's nature's way to get rid of that particular pregnancy.
So yeah, just like Dr. Knight was saying, it's a common cause of pregnancy loss. Even upwards of 50% can be attributed to chromosomal or genetic problems in the very early pregnancy.
Yeah. Okay. Does that answer your question, Rick?
You said 20%.
It's 1 in 5, 20%. Okay. Thank you very much for the call. We appreciate it. Let's go to Brad in Clarion County. Good evening, Brad. How are you?
I'm doing fine. I wanted to talk about my oldest daughter.
Okay.
She had her first baby and who came premature. She only carried her 6 months. And she only weighed 1 pound and 13 ounces. I wouldn't have thought she'd ever make it. We went out to see her. She was at the Geisinger Medical Center out east there. And if my daughter would have lived closer to us, I think we could have prevented that because she probably didn't have the care she should have had, the prenatal care. And so we went out to see that baby, and I thought, man, this baby's never going to live. But she's 34 years old now, but she's born blind.
Yeah, she was a fighter, huh?
Oh, my. And what a surprise. And her memory, you can't believe a memory she has. She went through the School for the Blind in Pittsburgh there, and she graduated from there, and she's got a job she works, and she won't miss a day's work.
That's fantastic.
Well, that sounds like a great story and a great outcome.
She comes into our house. She just walks around like she's able to see. She finds her way around easy and everything, but she never was able to see. That's how she grew, you know.
Does she use a support dog at all?
No.
Uh-huh. No. How about a cane? Does she use
a
cane?
No, she doesn't use a cane either.
Uh-huh. Well, that's amazing. That's amazing. Did she go to a school for the blind?
Yes, she went through the School for the Blind down in Pittsburgh there. She graduated from there.
Uh-huh. And what type of work does she do?
Well, what they do, they have bolts and nuts and washers at the place where she works, and they count them out and package them for shipment. They count them out, put so many in each envelope, and that's her job.
That's great. And you don't need eyes to do that, do you?
No. She's amazing.
Well, it sounds like your daughter is amazing. I mean,
She's my granddaughter, and
granddaughter,
she's along real well.
Okay, well, thank you so much for that good feel story, okay? Okay, give us a call, 866-391-1020. That's a pretty small baby, is it not, Dr. Kolthoff? 1 pound, 13 ounces, pretty small, less than 2 pounds. But, a lot of, like you were talking about, Dr. Knight, with technology, even 3 decades ago, that was a pretty good outcome. I mean, that child was probably in the lower percent of percentage range of being able to survive, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. That's a big advancement that technology has offered, is from the neonatal resuscitation side and gestational age at delivery.
Yeah. What's the smallest baby that you have seen that has survived?
Ooh, that's a great question. I've gestational age-wise, I've seen 23-week and a couple days. Yeah. So around 500 grams, I think.
Dr. Koldoff, how about you?
Yeah, same, 23 weeks.
Yeah, that's amazing. Almost half of the gestational period is not within the womb, which is really incredible when you think about it. You know, just a baby that can fit in the palm of your hand, you know. But, we talked about the fact that his granddaughter is blind, and that's something that does not occur very often today, right, Dr. Knight? It had to do with the oxygen levels that were given?
I believe, prematurity is definitely a risk factor for what I believe is retinopathy, is what I'm assuming maybe the cause was in that situation. And you're right, advancement with care that we've done from a perinatal standpoint has tried to limit that outcome.
Okay, well, let's go to our phone lines again. Terry in Crabtree. Good evening, Terry. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. Good evening. I have a question for the doctors. I was diagnosed at the age of 25 with neurofibromatosis, and it's isolated on my right facial nerve and the right side of my face. And I was wondering if that is seen in the practice and to what percent, and where you refer from there.
Okay, how about that, Dr. Koltoff? First of all, tell us what neurofibromatosis is, and is it genetically predisposed?
Yes, it is a genetic disorder. It's a neurocutaneous disorder. And that is something that not directly in our perinatology department that we can see, but we do have an adult genetic service as well, where we are happy to see individuals with genetic disease that affects them as an adult.
Okay. Would that individual be more inclined to propagate a child with the same problem?
Yes. Yes. It shows what's called autosomal dominant inheritance. So there's a 50-50 chance for each child to be affected.
Okay, Terry, does that answer your question?
The basic knowledge, but my real question is, why isn't it like in the criteria for the genetic testing? And there's two types of neurofibromas. One is hereditary and the other one isn't.
Okay. Dr. Koltoff?
So we typically don't do prenatal diagnosis for adult onset genetic disorders, aside from select cases. So I think that's one issue. And both types actually are genetic.
Okay. We're up against a real, real tight timeout. We need to say goodnight. We'll be back next week.
Medical Frontiers is an informational program sponsored by the Allegheny Health Network. The information featured on Medical Frontiers is intended solely to further the public's general knowledge of current developments in the field of medicine and should not be relied upon as offering advice, diagnosis, or opinions as to any individual treatment or problem. Nothing should replace the relationship that you maintain with your personal physician.